This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later on today's show, Focus on Technology looks at how the Reds and other major league teams are beefing up their data analytics departments. But first, imagine trying to deal with a disease that can cause you to hear voices in your head that disrupt your thinking and your ability to function. That's what people with schizophrenia face on a daily basis. It's a mental illness that afflicts more than 2 million adults in the U.S. There's a local project underway to help shed light on this often misunderstood disease and the people who suffer from it. And joining us this afternoon to talk about the Schizophrenia Oral History Project are co-founders Dr. Tracy McDonough, Associate Professor of Psychology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Linda Crane, Professor Emeritus at Mount St. Joseph, and Mount St. Joseph psychology student Rachel Jackson, who's involved in the project. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Linda, Rachel, and Tracy, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Tracy, start us off by telling us a little bit more about what schizophrenia is.
Well, schizophrenia is considered a psychotic disorder where folks have periods where they lose touch with reality. The symptoms can vary, but most folks struggle with the two what we consider hallmark symptoms of schizophrenia, delusions and hallucinations.
Tracy, this is something that's often misunderstood. I think people sometimes refer to this as a split personality disorder, and that's not what it is at all, is it?
Absolutely not, and that is a very common misunderstanding. Schizophrenia does mean split brain, and I think that may be where that misunderstanding comes, but it's more of a split from reality or a break from reality.
Linda, what causes schizophrenia? Do we have much of an idea on that?
No, unfortunately not. We understand that it's a physical brain disorder. It's not something that's caused from problems in childhood or other kinds of adjustment issues. There's a genetic component to it. We know that. There are certain things that probably interact with that genetic component, things that the mother can have prenatally. That perhaps create the illness later on in life. But it's a complicated disorder, and the mechanism by which it develops is not clearly understood.
Well, I've even heard, too, Linda, that this is it could be eight diseases. There are some researchers who think it might be not just one, but eight different things. What's your understanding on that?
My understanding is that it may be a cluster of disorders. When you look at symptoms like delusions and hallucinations, the other kinds of things, lack of initiative, the inability to get up and get going, really people are very, very tired many times. Those kinds of things could happen for more than one reason, and it does complicate research when a number of people with similar symptoms get grouped together, and it may not be coming from the same cause.
Where does it stand, Tracy, in relation to other mental illnesses? How many people suffer from this? How many new cases are diagnosed each year? I think the figure I saw was like 2.5 million adults. Do we have any idea exactly how many?
Well, approximately 1% of the population. So, of course, as the population grows, unfortunately, that number grows as well. I haven't seen an increase in the number of folks with schizophrenia. However, I think we are getting better at diagnosing it than we used to years ago.
Now, Linda, you were mentioning that the genetics can play a role. How big of a role can genetics play?
I think it's a very large role in the sense that people are unlikely to develop schizophrenia if they don't have the genetic component. But the genetics are complicated as well. My understanding is that it's not just a single gene, but a configuration of genes that creates the predisposition for schizophrenia.
And I'd like to chime in here. There was a very recent study that came out of Harvard and Boston Children's Hospital February. And they were looking at genetic contribution to schizophrenia, suggesting that it may be an over-pruning of the brain's neural connections. We know that the brain prunes off connections that we don't use twice in our lifetime. And the second time is roughly late teens, early 20s, which corresponds with when schizophrenia tends to develop for the first time in many people. This is really early research, but it's something brand new and may give us some more information in the future.
Well, what age does it most commonly occur?
Well, for men, it's late teens and early 20s. For women, it can be a little bit older, but not as old. At one point, we thought it was more in the 30s for women, but the research is suggesting not that late for women on average for their first, what we call, psychotic break.
Do we have any idea how many people in the Cincinnati area suffer from this?
I haven't seen specific numbers lately, but I do believe it's consistent with that roughly 1% of the population.
Linda, what are the challenges faced by people who have schizophrenia? What is life like for someone who suffers from this?
The challenges for someone with schizophrenia are very severe. It is a thought disorder. It keeps people from being able to think logically and clearly. And, of course, logical thinking is the basis for all of the decisions that we make in life. In addition to the hallucinations and delusions, there are what they call the negative symptoms, which means that it's something that isn't happening rather than something that is. And those negative symptoms involve the kinds of things that I talked about earlier, where the people are just unable to motivate themselves. It's not that they're lazy, but just that they can't get themselves going. And that can be so severe that it keeps people even from being able to keep themselves clean or their homes clean.
Is there a lot of stigma around this disease?
Oh, a tremendous amount of stigma. Oftentimes people are misunderstood as, like Linda said, maybe lazy because of the negative symptoms. A huge misunderstanding is the thought that people with schizophrenia are violent. And our research tells us that folks with schizophrenia are much more likely to be victims of crime than they are perpetrators. With someone walking down the street responding to the voices in their head, they're an easy target for predators. A few folks with schizophrenia have become violent, and I think because those stories have made the news, that has contributed to the misunderstanding and stigma.
Yeah, a term I've heard is paranoid schizophrenia. What is that?
That's a form of schizophrenia where folks have what's called paranoia, which are delusions or beliefs that other forces or other people are out to harm them. And some of folks with paranoid schizophrenia can occasionally become violent, but more than likely folks with paranoid schizophrenia will isolate because they're very afraid.
So is isolation a big part of this, Linda?
Yes, it is. In fact, people who have schizophrenia often find that, well, they do find that their lives change completely. They don't have friends that they used to have. Their families even many times have trouble understanding what they're going through and relating to them. So they become isolated socially, as well as Tracy says, tending to hide away many times because they find the world very confusing and very fearsome.
Are there any warning signs or symptoms that could alert families that the bigger problems are on the way?
Well, let me see if I can throw that over to Linda since she does have a family experience with schizophrenia.
Well, one of the things is that in the chronic form of schizophrenia, in the chronic form of psychosis, which we call schizophrenia, it comes on very slowly. Individuals don't just wake up someday psychotic. In fact, if one does wake up suddenly psychotic, the outcome is typically much better. So it's a gradual onset, and typically families don't imagine that someone is developing schizophrenia. That's not the first thing that comes to their mind. They may see that there are problems that are developing. The individual may become less likely to want to spend time with their friends than they used to. They may occasionally say very strange things that disturb the family, but it's gradual.
Linda, what are some of the common triggers to a person's first psychotic break?
Well, one of the very strong predictors is stress of one kind or another. individuals. Stress doesn't cause the schizophrenia, but it can cause the psychotic breaks to be more likely. And usually before the first psychotic break, there's been some form of stress. It may not be what we would consider to be severe stress. It might be for a young person that they're just going off to school, to college. It might be some normal change in life, but it typically happens when there's some stressful situation. The other thing that there is some research about more recently is that drugs can trigger a first psychotic break. And again, it's not that the drugs create the schizophrenia, but it can cause it to happen. Even drugs that we think of as not typically causing harm, like marijuana.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And Tracy, how treatable is schizophrenia?
Oh, schizophrenia is very treatable. But when I say treatable, I'm not saying cure. We haven't found
a cure. It's chronic, right?
Correct.
Something you're going to be with have for the rest of your life.
Most folks, yes. A piece of research that just came out in October from NIMH, they looked at folks across multiple sites, 34 clinics in 21 states. What they found is that the earlier you intervene, the better the outcome, particularly if you can intervene with some combined treatment, medication, family support, school and work support, one-on-one talk therapy. If you can have that combination in after that first psychotic break, then that really improves outcomes. Unfortunately, that's tough to do because oftentimes folks at that point in their lives are really struggling with accepting, oh, my brain is working against me in a way that I can't control. But that with treatment, folks with schizophrenia can do much better.
Now, early intervention, are there any predictors or warning signs in younger children?
Well, we don't typically see necessarily younger signs in younger children. There are cases of children that have shown symptoms of schizophrenia. That is rare. And as I think Linda can even better speak to, oftentimes in childhood, you don't see any indicators that someone might develop schizophrenia later on.
Linda, go ahead and talk to that some, because you did have your son was schizophrenic, and you do have a lot of experience with this.
My son developed schizophrenia, and I was at that time a graduate student in psychology and had an externship at a state hospital working with people who had schizophrenia, and I still didn't see it in him. This is the kind of thing that I mean when I say that it comes on so very slowly. I mean, of all the kinds of things that I imagined, that was the last. And he had not shown any signs previously at all. He, at the time that my son actually committed suicide after he had suffered with schizophrenia for 7 years. And at the funeral, I remember a cousin of my husband's saying, he's the last person that I ever would have imagined would have developed something like this. So, no, you know, he didn't show any signs, and many times individuals do not.
We will continue our conversation about schizophrenia and the Schizophrenia Oral History Project. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Dr. Tracy McDonough, Associate Professor of Psychology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Linda Crane, Professor Emeritus at Mount St. Joseph, and Mount St. Joseph Psychology student Rachel Jackson, as we talk about schizophrenia and the Schizophrenia Oral History Project. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Rachel, how did you get involved in all this?
Well, Dr. McDonough was my abnormal psychology professor, and I actually didn't come into MSJ as a psychology major, and she's the reason I switched. And I went into her office one day in hopes of obtaining another opportunity in psychology, and she ended up talking about her project, and I took a look at her website after she gave me her card, and I was like, oh, that would be really cool to get involved with. And then later on, Dr. Linda Crane came to talk into one of our classes in abnormal psych, And her story about her son really got me emotionally, and that was when I decided I needed to help with this project.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us. And let's talk with Judy in Northside. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First, I wanted to say thank you so much for having this as a topic today. It's something that has really been held for so long as the great secret, and it's important to have these things come to light. My personal experience was that my father and several of his family members suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. My father had a very successful career in the Air Force. He was a fighter pilot, base commander when I was a child. But the disease progressed as he got older to the point where he would no longer take his medication, and it degenerated to the point where in 1987 he actually shot and murdered my mother. And we all have recovered from that. It was a long time ago.
So, well, I'm sorry to hear about that, though. That's
thank you. But it's important to note, and I know that many people who do suffer from schizophrenia are not violent, but I think that it's important to note that if violence does become a component, that it's very important to keep a close eye on it. My mom never thought that my father would go that far, and of course he did. We have in our family been more mindful. Fortunately, my siblings and I are okay, but I just wanted I just wanted to bring that point up, that that it is important if that is a component, to be particularly mindful. But thanks again so much for having this topic today. I think it's wonderful.
Thank you, Judy, for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Judy. I appreciate it as well. And she makes a point about how her father, as he was struggling more, chose not to take the medication anymore. And that's a very common thing with folks who struggle with schizophrenia, because the side effects of the medication are unpleasant. Folks can have what's called akathisia, where it feels like their limbs, their legs and their arms are moving or tremoring. Some folks can get facial tics. And even if you stop some of the medications, particularly the older ones, sometimes those facial tics don't go away. Some folks emotionally can feel somewhat blunted. One of my folks I used to work with described it as thinking through jello sometimes, that her thought process was difficult in that way. And so some folks do struggle with that. Weight gain is another side effect. We know that folks with schizophrenia tend to have a shorter life expectancy due to metabolism issues, diabetes, things that are related somewhat to the illness, but more commonly to the medication.
And we were talking about how this is a treatable disease. Can it be treated other ways besides medication, or is that the only way?
Medication is the primary intervention.
Okay.
Because what medication does is helps with the what are called neurotransmitters, the chemicals in one's brain, and trying to regulate that a little better. We do know that folks who take longer to have some type of medication, the longer the brain is kind of swimming in this toxic neural soup, in essence, they don't do as well. Folks who go on and off the medications over time, some of them can become less effective for them. So certainly that's not the only intervention, and the goal would be to try to reduce the dosage as much as is helpful to the person. But most folks do need to have some type of medication on board.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And let's talk with Jimmy. Good afternoon, Jimmy.
Hello, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Sure can. Go right ahead.
Hey, how are you, doctor? Hi, doctor. Miss?
Hi.
I'm all right for a young man. My name is Jimmy, and I'm a Vietnam combat veteran. And for years, we heard about schizophrenia, paranoia, and post-traumatic stress, dual diagnosis, and so forth. And we then wondered, what we know what paranoia is. We know what post-traumatic stress was. But we never understood what's the symptoms for schizophrenia. What is the symptoms? We know paranoia has a symptom. But a lot of us, we were confused, and we used to mention that word, schizophrenia, he's schizophrenic. But we never knew what schizophrenia really, what's the symptoms. What is the identity to recognize schizophrenia? And after you tell me this, real quickly, I was going to comment, make a statement, but tell me, could you give us an answer there while we're listening? The other veterans at the VA hospital and veterans over at the domicile over in Fort Thomas, other veterans that may be listening, what is the symptoms of, what is the sign of schizophrenia?
Sure, Jimmy. Thanks for calling. The symptoms I mentioned a little bit ago are delusions and hallucinations are some of the primary ones. Now, a hallucination is a sensation that someone experiences that's not coming from the outside. For example, what we call hearing voices. That stimulation's coming from the inside of the head rather than hearing a voice outside, like a friend calling to you from across the room or something. So those hallucinations most commonly are auditory, hearing some kind of voice. Some folks can experience visual hallucinations, so seeing things, but that's less common. And the hallucinations that folks experience, the voices can vary. Some folks hear one voice, so other folks hear multiple. Some folks can make out what the voices are saying, whereas other folks it sounds like there's just mumbling. And sometimes the voices tell people to do things. And so these hallucinations can lead to the delusions. And that's a belief that couldn't possibly be real. For example, the belief that the FBI is monitoring me. So if a voice is telling me that, I might start to believe that. And so that's what we call a delusion, the belief.
And Jimmy also wanted to know, and Linda, maybe you can field this one. Jimmy wanted to know if there's a connection between PTSD and schizophrenia.
No, there isn't a direct connection between those things. I mean, somebody with schizophrenia, of course, could also develop PTSD, but there isn't a causal connection between the two at all. One thing I will say about the hallucinations is that it isn't that people imagine that they're hearing voices. They actually do hear them. So for the person who is experiencing this, it sounds to them for all the world like someone has spoken, at least initially. After the person has more experience with the illness, they can oftentimes tell the difference. But initially, it's very difficult for them to distinguish between the voice that they hear inside their head and something that somebody said out loud. The brain is just functioning in such a way that it's sending voices. It's not that they imagine it.
I can't imagine dealing with that. And this is pretty much a daily thing that somebody with schizophrenia is going through?
They can, particularly if they're not taking any medication, but it can vary from folks, but oftentimes they can experience those voices on a daily basis and even sometimes multiple times during the day. Some folks tell us that they're hearing voices all the time, all day.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation, and Eileen in Blue Ash joins us now. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question for the doctors. Is it likely that when you are diagnosed with another disorder, say bipolar disorder, that it's actually masking the symptoms of schizophrenia? And can someone develop those symptoms of schizophrenia much later in their life after a life of treating and sometimes not treating the bipolar? Do you understand my question?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I do. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
Well, what I would suggest is more likely the case is that perhaps the person has been struggling with schizophrenia, but it may have been misdiagnosed. Folks who have major depressive disorder or bipolar disorder can also have some psychotic symptoms, potentially hear voices or have delusions. But the difference is that for those folks, the symptoms, the voices, the delusions will only occur within a mood period, a period of depression or a period of mania. When those types of symptoms occur outside of a mood period, then they're more likely to be schizophrenia. And then there is another disorder called schizoaffective disorder, and that's where an individual can experience those psychotic symptoms both within a mood period and outside of a mood period. I tend to refer to that disorder to my students as the mother load of diagnoses because it's pretty much everything.
Well, and we were talking earlier, too, Tracy, about the idea that, that there's been some research indicating this could be more than just one disease at work. It could be multiple diseases at the same time.
Absolutely. It can be, like Linda referred to, as a cluster of disorders. Some folks experience the paranoid type of schizophrenia. Other folks can experience what we call catatonic schizophrenia, where they tend to be more immobile in their behavior and their and verbally potentially even unresponsive. Those are just two examples of some real significant differences in how it may present.
And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we had an anonymous email from a person who had two friends with schizophrenia. And he said both became very paranoid about friends cheating with their girlfriends or talking about them behind their back. Linda, is that a common kind of hallucination that the people with schizophrenia experience?
Well, that would be more a delusion. It's an idea that isn't correct, but the person believes it just the same. And that idea, that suspicion toward others, is really the what paranoia is. And that's one of the reasons that individuals with schizophrenia can become very isolated, because they become suspicious of their friends. They begin acting differently than they used to, and their friends tend to start to avoid them because of that kind of behavior. Several times we've talked so far about treatment, and that's something that I wanted to be sure to mention. It has been mentioned, but to speak to it again, is that the treatment is so very, very important. And one of the reasons that individuals tend not to get treatment is because of the misunderstanding and stigma surrounding it. To have schizophrenia just seems like, oh my goodness, that's just the worst thing that could possibly happen. And it's understandably difficult for people to come to terms with that, to say, well, this is really what's happening to me, and I really need treatment. So Tracy and I believe that the more people understand, the more there's public understanding of the illness and accurate understanding of what's actually going on, that perhaps the willingness to seek treatment will be greater.
Valerie emailed about Finland's open dialogue treatment. She says it involves talk therapy, less medications. Thoughts on that, Tracy?
Well, that sounds similar to the piece of research I was just mentioning from NIMH. At one point in time years ago, we didn't think that folks with schizophrenia could participate in talk therapy. Now we're coming to understand that many folks can. Even though folks may struggle with periods of delusions or hallucinations, folks with schizophrenia also have periods of time where they're quite lucid and can be very bright people. We have some of folks in our project that have shown us evidence of definitely higher ethical system, great compassion, and certainly the ability to interact with another person in a therapy kind of circumstance is something that they could participate in. Again, the medication is important to have on, usually on board at the same time, but it's not the only intervention, and that's what we thought in the 50s when the meds first came out.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk with Mark and Anderson. Hi, Mark.
Hello there. Okay, so my wife has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. They called it nonspecific. I think that just meant they couldn't narrow it down beyond that. She's high functioning in the sense that she gets a lot done. One of my main things was she doesn't really acknowledge an illness. Even though she was diagnosed, she was in Summit Behavioral for 90 days and then Deaconess another time. And so maybe you can comment on patients that don't even acknowledge their condition. She did accept a shot, a risperidone shot, which is supposed to be good for a month. And it was a terrible experience for her. And while it did make her much more docile, it was just too much, and it was a disaster. I actually went in to the doctor and endorsed her request to not get another one. So she went off everything, and so now all these symptoms are back. By the way, her symptoms fall under what I would call a more subtle quality, not always bizarre beliefs, but constant sort of bizarre beliefs. I guess that's enough for now.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
And what Mark's describing is not uncommon. I mentioned the side effects of the medication can be unpleasant, but it's the first phase of treatment is oftentimes helping the person to accept that they do have the illness, because it is quite a struggle, particularly as Linda had described. If it comes on gradually, some things can appear off for a little while and other things are doing okay for a while. So oftentimes folks really do struggle with this. And I think that's also related to stigma, because to say that I struggle with this mental illness in many ways is a way of saying that I think I'm crazy or I know I'm crazy. And we use that word so terribly and so often. And so struggling with the acceptance of the disorder is a big roadblock initially.
We will continue our conversation about schizophrenia and the Schizophrenia Oral History Project. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. Coming up later in Focus on Technology, Ann Thompson tells us how major league teams are using data analytics to try to gain advantage over the competition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We're talking about schizophrenia and the Schizophrenia Oral History Project with Dr. Tracy McDonough, Associate Professor of Psychology at Mount St. Joseph University, Dr. Linda Crane, who's Professor Emeritus at Mount St. Joseph, and Mount St. Joseph psychology student Rachel Jackson. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Linda, let's talk about the project that's underway. Now, this got started because of what happened with your son, is that right?
Well, yes, I became interested in oral history anyway, just interested in the impact that stories can have and how we can come to understand any phenomena through oral history in a way that's different from any other kind of research, and went to an oral history conference and came back very excited about some project or another that I might do with oral history, and thinking about the possibility of providing this kind of an oral history project to individuals who have schizophrenia, because they are so unlikely to be heard. They probably are one of the, perhaps the population in the United States is, in terms of people who have illnesses, who are the least likely to be heard. People discount them. They imagine that they have no ability, as Tracy was talking about earlier, to speak coherently or to provide any insight. And that's clearly not true. So I asked Tracy if she might want to be involved in this project with me, and she did, and we launched the project.
Tracy, how many people have taken part so far?
Right now we have 40 narrators that we have spoken to. We have about 25 up on our website right now. Several are in the hopper, going to be uploaded to the website soon. Go ahead.
So what kind of benefits do you see for these folks?
Well, first of all, we believe that the act of telling their stories in and of itself is empowering. Most of these folks don't get eye contact when they walk down the street. Folks that we've spoken to have an awareness that other people may think that they're violent, think that they're strange. They are aware that other folks may be making fun of them on the bus, that type of thing. And so the fact that these two strangers say to them, hey, your story is interesting and important enough that we want to record it. That is, I believe, a new experience. One of our narrators that we spoke to, a woman by the name of Shirley, we went back after we had recorded her story to give her her materials, and we do that with all the narrators we can recontact. And she's looking at some feedback that we'd receive from people who had come to public talks. We gather audience feedback, and she's looking at this feedback, and she starts to, tears start to well up. And she looks at us and says, this is the first time I felt like I matter. A woman in her 40s, and this is the first moment in her life where she simply felt like she mattered. So I think that's a pretty powerful thing.
Rachel, tell me about your involvement in the project.
Well, right now, this is my first semester helping out. It's a project that Dr. McDonough developed as sort of a co-opportunity to develop the project and also give a student a really great opportunity to develop their strengths. So what I'm doing is I'm eventually going to develop a project based on my strengths that's also helping the schizophrenia oral history project. And I haven't quite decided what that will be, but I think it's going to be around something about the significant portion of homeless people who have a mental illness or schizophrenia.
Yeah, are other students involved in the project like you are?
Just one other, because it's the pilot class. So I think that maybe in the future there will be more. But we are also having, it's such an in-depth project that I don't know how many people Dr. McDonough could take on for individual meetings.
Well, then how's this changed your perception of schizophrenia?
Oh my gosh, tremendously. I probably did not know anything about schizophrenia before her abnormal psychology course. And then I learned about it, and previously all I had thought about were the people who would get a gun and be scared of people and shoot people, and that was the perception. And after learning about people with schizophrenia, I learned a lot more that they're not dangerous. They're a lot more likely to be the victim, and I wanted to help tell that story.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Deborah in Price Hill. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. Thank you for having this conversation. I do think hearing people's stories makes a big difference. I'm part of a holistic mental health network where we look at biopsychosocial influences of mental health issues, including schizophrenia. And we brought a psychiatrist to town, Daniel Fisher, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia in his 20s and was able to recover. So I just want to say there's no research that it's a brain disease. There's a brain disease. That's what the common parlance is now, but there is no evidence. There's brain changes, and some of that's from medication. But there's something, and I'm wondering if people have heard of open dialogue in Finland, where they're using that with people with first psychotic breaks, and they're having a lot of success where they're not putting people on medication, but coming into the situation and talking with people and helping make sense of what's going on. And we're not putting money into that. We're putting money into pharmaceutical research and not into things like Open Dialogue or the Windhorse Project, and I'd really like to hear more about those kind of projects.
Deborah, thank you for the call.
Well, the problem, I think, with those types of projects, well, not a problem, but the challenge, is that they do tend to be more expensive. In our country, I think we do tend to go more towards pharmaceuticals because they are faster intervention. They are more likely to be reimbursed by insurance companies, whereas someone who's going to get the more psychosocial interventions do need a good deal of support and a good deal of support for a good period of time. And that can be so wonderful and very helpful, but it can be hard to keep into place for periods of time.
May I say something?
Sure, Linda. Go right ahead, Linda.
In my own experience, too, I would be very careful about assuming that in most cases or in many cases, schizophrenia can be treated without the use of medication. And I'll tell you why. First is the research that Tracy talked about earlier that suggests the problems with recovery when the disorder is left untreated for a long period of time. Now, our medication isn't what we would like for it to be. We don't have something at this point that can just bring people back to where they were previously most of the time. But in my own case with my son, we had a situation where finally, after a number of years of being treated, that he was beginning to get back to the place where he was at least functioning. He was taking care of himself. He had a part-time job. He looked much better. He was gaining some friends and so on. And because our medical system here, treating schizophrenia at least at that time, was very much in disarray, he had a different doctor just about every 2 or 3 months. I mean, somebody left and somebody else came. He sees a new person that he hadn't seen previously. And that person, because he was doing so well, says to him, I don't think you have schizophrenia, really. At which point he, of course, stopped taking the medication. And he just dropped like a rock. I mean, he was worse than he had ever been within just a few days. And he never really got back to the place where he had been before. So I think the situation is complicated, and that we have to be careful about saying in any given instance that people can get along without medication, because I think there have been some unfortunate things happen from that.
Linda, if someone refuses to take their medication, is there anything a family member can do?
Well, that's a really hard situation. Yes, you can have the person involuntarily committed, and oftentimes that's what is required in that case. Not so much because the person needs to be hospitalized 24/7, but because sometimes that's the only thing you can do to get them to be forced to take the medication. And in order to do that, you have to have a psychiatrist that will say, in fact, two of them, that will say that the person is either a danger to themselves or others. So it's a very difficult situation, and families are placed in a very difficult situation in trying to help their family member in those kinds of circumstances.
Linda, has the Schizophrenia Oral History Project, has that even changed your views about the disease since you've been doing this?
Yeah, I think it has. I think it has. I went into it with the belief that individuals with schizophrenia have something to say, something that other people need to hear about themselves and their lives. I think it's very difficult to continue to believe that most people with schizophrenia are violent and have no insight when you come face to face with our narrators, who are oftentimes, usually, very sweet people who have a lot of insight and in with whom we can all relate. An audience member really can't go away from that and with the same idea that they had previously. So I had hopes for that, but I didn't really expect to see, I think even in my own circumstance, I didn't really expect to be able to relate to our narrators the way I have, or to be impressed with their struggle the way I have been.
Tracy, how can people contact the project?
Well, we do have a website, www.schizophreniaoralhistories.com, and we do have a way on the website where someone could contact us to either ask questions. We have a phone number as well as an email address to me. Also, for folks who would like to tell us their story, what we're doing in the project is asking folks to come tell us their life story. And some talk about having schizophrenia, some don't. But it's important for us that it's their story. So they contact us that way because it's an ongoing project.
And we've got just about 30 seconds left. You'll be taking part in an event in May, speaking of storytelling. Tell us what that is.
Yes, that's the next round of Enquirer newspaper's Storytellers Project. And on Wednesday, May the 4th, from 7 to 9 at the Phoenix, this round, the theme is Living and Dying, and I'll be talking about my experiences with the project.
Well, thanks all of you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.